what is systolic and what is diastolic. To understand the meaning of systole and diastole, the heart pumps blood, right? To pump blood, it needs to contract and then relax. Contract and then relax. So when the heart contracts, the blood escapes from the heart and goes to the rest of the body. When the heart relaxes, blood comes back from the body and fills inside the chambers of the heart. So you cannot have just pumping without filling it. You know, if you take a small pipette or a syringe, you can't just have it incessantly putting out water. It needs to get filled. So therefore, the heart has two components, systole when it contracts, diastole when it reacts.
Hello everyone, this is Vikas and you are listening to Run With Fitpage. This is episode number 139 and today we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Adil Sadiq. He is the head and senior consultant cardiothoracic and vascular surgery at Sakra World Hospital in Bangalore. You will see from the conversation today, and that is on the basis of a lot of requests from several of you that you wanted to know more about heart health. You will see that we discuss one of the most important and one of the most prominent diseases that exist today in India. That is coronary arteries disease. We went into the length and breadth of it and understood from Dr. Adil why it is important to know more, understand more, prevent this early, and take a number of steps that will help you to not get into a situation that is considered an event. Of course, a cardiac event is not the event that you want to go through. If you want to be able to walk well, if you want to be able to continue on your sustainable running journey, triathlon journey, etc., it's important that you are healthy to be able to do that. And more often than not, and I've seen that from various instances in the country in the last 1 year or so, we do not know enough about it. And that is why you will see in the last several conversations, we are focusing on talking about various health conditions. Today in the conversation, Dr. Adil Sadiq has very kindly taken us through various details of understanding heart, its function. Analogies that he draws for us to understand from normal lives are really important because that is how we will understand it, isn't it? In layman's term, you will see that we know so much more by the end of the conversation that we can take clear actions to understand where we are and possibly take actions subsequently basis the results that come by. Let's discuss with Dr. Adil about coronary arteries disease and come out more educated, more informed. What I have also taken the liberty that based on feedback from this conversation, if you want to understand more about other cardiac issues, more about other heart conditions, he's very happy to come back on the podcast and speak about other issues. So please let me know after this conversation through review, feedback via email, social media, you know where I am, where we are, and we'll be very happy to request Dr. Adil to come back and speak to us again. For today, let's get into the conversation, understand more about heart health and about coronary arteries disease. Dr. Adil, welcome to Run With Fitpage. It's our weekly show. It's a great pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be on this. I've heard so much about it, and I know you're really going places, running places, literally. So let's hit it.
Thank you. 2017 is when we met first, and we went through certain procedures, and that helped me come back on my feet and start running again. And that memory has been with me, and I thought today through this conversation, we can spend some time digging in your expertise and talk about heart and heart health, something that you do almost on a daily basis, something that's extremely important for everybody to live, survive, and also for longevity. I thought we start by maybe a small introduction of yours. Lot of people know of you, of course, but lot others may not know of you.
No, you're very kind. I think, you know, Let's start off. I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon. My name is Adil Sadiq. I work at a Japanese hospital in Bangalore that's run by Toyota and Secom. It's called Sakra World Hospital. It's been, say, approximately my 23rd year of doing cardiothoracic surgery. So it's been quite some time.
Wow. And you moved back from the US to India several years ago.
That is correct. Approximately around 11, 12 years ago, I moved back from the United States. And in these 12 years, I've seen at least 4 governments change. So
that's still a lot lesser number.
Yes.
Awesome. Let's get into the details of heart. When we talk about fitness, I've seen from my experiences, people think of gyms. They think of going hitting the gym, picking up these heavy dumbbells, bicep curls, and chest presses. I see a lot. I'm also seeing increasingly now focus on cardiovascular fitness. This is what we do for a living, where we try to educate people more and more about cardiovascular fitness and why it's important. And when it comes to cardiovascular fitness, heart is at the very heart of it. So I thought we seek your help in understanding what is the basic function of heart? What is it? How is it built? How does it operate for a layman?
Okay, so to put it very simple, I'd like to draw an analogy, a comparison. If you have a car, then the engine of that car is the heart of the car. It's the same thing in the body. The entire blood circulation in the body is being facilitated by the heart, which means the heart pumps blood. That's the basic job of the heart. And the blood goes through the entire body, carries so many things like food, oxygen, comes back to the heart. The heart then pumps it to the lungs, gets it oxygenated, brings it to another part of the heart, and then pumps it throughout the body. So it's a cycle that keeps going on and on. And that's the basic function of the heart. So it pumps blood to the entire body. And since it's a pumping organ, it consists of muscle. So primarily it consists of muscle. There are 4 chambers or rooms, 2 on the right side, 2 on the left side. Each of the rooms has a door that's an entrance point. And this door in medical terms is called a valve. So each chamber has 1 valve. So the heart has 4 chambers, 4 valves. All the valves are unidirectional, which means it's like a traffic light. You know, it's a one-way street. So the blood has to go one direction so that the blood does not go back the other way. So sometimes if you have problems in that, that's not good. So this is how the heart works. Unidirectional flow of blood pumping through and through. And the most important thing is there are different kinds of muscles in the body. You know, lots of muscles, and I'm sure the people who are listening to this can name more muscles than I would at one spot. But this is the only muscle that goes on incessantly. That means from the day that you're born till the day you die, this muscle never stops.
Wow. Yeah. And that's our effort to keep it going for as long as possible without any stoppage. Great analogy with the car, because when I start to think of it, I think of it, the engine is carrying the fuel, the lubricants, and it's supplying to various parts of the car. And that's converting that into energy, and then that's propelling the car forward or reverse wherever it's needed. And it seems like that's the work of the heart as well, where it's pumping blood, and blood is nourishing the body, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's correct. Except the heart works differently on certain days of the year, like Valentine's Day. So, but apart from that, that is exactly what the heart does. True.
Awesome. So, as we grow older, we've seen that we start to go through and rather, we are asked by the doctors or hospitals in our offices, etc. We are suggested to go through certain tests, and that includes cardiac profiles and things like those. And we are told that as you start to age, as you start to earn, in many ways, you start to invite certain conditions because we stop doing certain other things that we were doing when We were kids when you used to move a lot, etc. And here comes this huge topic of discussion where we start to get worried from many results as soon as the pathology result comes. I think up until we are studying, we are worried by our grades, and after that, we start to worry from the grades that come from these results. So what's happening here? Why heart is all fine or mostly fine up until a particular age? And because of certain lifestyle interventions, because of nutrition, or what is it, why there are certain conditions that start to take place in the heart and people start to get worried about it?
True. So at the outset, I'd like to say that, you know, the heart disease can be broadly classified into two kinds. One, which is acquired, which is what we're talking about, which comes after time because of certain lifestyle conditions or decisions that we make. And the second is something that you are born with, and that is called congenital, that you're born with it. So let's focus on what we can do and what we can take care of, and that's the acquired heart disease. Now, just like, you know, no matter, I like to draw the analogy again to the car. It's very simple for people to understand. You may buy a fantastic car, a BMW or a Mercedes, let it be a Ferrari, but if you don't maintain it over time, you're going to run into problems, okay? And if you have tires and those tires have done 50,000 kilometers, they are going to show wear and tear. And that's also going to happen with different components of the heart, okay? So if you use substandard fuel, you're going to have a problem. If you do not change your transmission oil or your brake oil, you're going to have problems. If you do not take your car for servicing on a regular basis, so let's say an annual basis, you're going to have a problem. The same thing happens with the heart. So, you know, as we age, you know, I think the efficiency of the heart, the mechanics of the heart are mind-blowing. And I don't think any kind of engine so far can recapitulate that kind of precision, you know. It's amazing. But nonetheless, with age, with time, with lifestyle, there are influences which affect the heart. And this is what I think I need to talk to people, because a lot of them are preventable. You know, you can actually take control of it and prevent many, many things. For example, let's start off with the most common disease people associate the heart with, and that's called coronary artery disease. Now, what does that mean? It means that the blood arteries supplying the heart have some kind of a problem. They have some kind of a block, which means the gasoline pipes which supply the engine, give petrol, have some kind of problems, you know. If you take a metal pipe and you put soft water running through it, nothing's going to happen there. But if you put hard water, you know, it's only a matter of time that you're going to have calcium concretions inside the pipe, okay? So what we put in our body is what goes through these arteries. So there are seven basic reasons why people develop coronary artery disease. And today when we take the data points, the number one reason across the world for premature early coronary artery disease is diabetes, number one. Okay, number two is exposure to tobacco in either form, firsthand or secondhand. Number three is genetics. You may have a history of heart disease in your family, either one parent or two parents, or, you know, there's a high history of cholesterol or triglycerides in your body. That's going to affect you. Number four, high blood pressure. Okay, number five, lack of exercise. And, you know, and I mean to say the different kinds of exercise. We can go on about that for more than 20 minutes. Number six, bad food habits, you know. And it's just not about being vegetarian or non-vegetarian. It's all the other things, you know, your vada pav in Mumbai, you know, the whole kind of fried Indian savory condiments, lots of ghee, so many other things, you know, that is disproportionate to your activity. What is important is a balanced diet is important, but having disproportionate calories to your activity, that's bad for you. Last but not least is stress. Stress is not the only factor. Stress is a contributory factor. With along the other factors, the amalgamation leads to a host of problems. So these are the things in our lifestyle that very commonly lead to coronary artery disease.
Wow. There are so many sub-questions coming to my mind as a result of what you just said, because I've seen you know, we do not study physiology, we do not study sports nutrition, and at times what happens that by the time we even realize it's too late, because we don't know what we are eating is right or not. I remember when I came to the city for the first time, I thought the sign of prosperity is to have a lot of Coca-Cola and have a lot of pizzas, because that seemed synonymous to having a prosperous lifestyle, and also burgers. And it seemed like that was my that was almost my daily routine for years to come. And only after a certain point of time, I realized that none of this is right. So you talked about a few points within the seven primary reasons, which I think are in our control if we know of it early on, in our control to a certain degree, right? So
absolutely.
And I was thinking maybe we pick up two or three as part of that, which are very widely told, and so people are aware to some degree, but generally they either live in denial or don't know enough of it. Like, for example, I have seen, at least in my village, when I speak with people, and they live in denial when they see their blood pressure, and if it's instead of being 120 by 80, if it's 140, 145 by 90 or such, they will start to say, yeah, it may be that the machine wasn't right, or maybe I was a little stressed, or XYZ. How about we start with this itself? Why blood pressure is supposed to be the way it is? And as I know, most of the species, with possibly an exception of giraffe, has 120 by 80 as the blood pressure, isn't it? So why it is the way it is, and why there could be certain changes to start with, and what it does to the body?
Sure. It's very important to understand the basic reason why we have a blood pressure. And to understand that, there's a lot of physics in it. There is some amount of atmospheric pressure around us, outside of us. And if we want the blood to circulate throughout our body, it has to negate the effect of the atmospheric pressure from outside. So by virtue of that, the blood should have some amount of pressure being generated so it can circulate around the body. Okay, so this is what it is. So given that the atmospheric pressure in most places is the same, say at sea level, therefore a certain amount of blood pressure is being maintained. And using that principle, if we go on to a higher altitude, there we find that a blood pressure tends to increase, even for normal people, until we kind of get adjusted to that particular level, altitude. And that is called acclimatization. It takes some time to happen. So even varying altitude, latitude will change the blood pressure, because the blood circulates against atmospheric pressure, helps maintain skin turgidity, and so on and so forth. Now, the blood pressure is being maintained because blood is flowing through certain channels or pipes, and these pipes are called arteries. And there is a tone in these arteries, you know. So the greater the tone, the greater the resistance, greater the pressure. It's all physics. It's based on an equation called Bernoulli's equation, but I won't go into that. But it just means that you know, if you're stressed about something, there's more pressure in the arteries, your BP will go up. That's the whole thing. Also, what happens about these arteries is they are bond elastic, which means they can change the elasticity properties over time, and that's good. The more elastic your arteries are, the more your blood pressure will accommodate and be in the normal range when exposed to different conditions. Now, there are certain situations in which this elasticity is lost and the arteries become plastic, which means they lose their ability to fluctuate and expand. They lose the capacitance power. They lose the power to buffer the variations, and that's why blood pressure starts going out of your control. Okay, some of the reasons why this plasticity can occur is, one, aging, so denaturing of proteins, and that lifestyle diseases as well, you know. So a lot of lifestyle changes can secrete hormones that can make these arteries age faster, become more plastic. Lots of cholesterol deposition, lots of inflammation in these arteries, all of them can make the elasticity go away, increase the plasticity, and therefore the blood pressure goes higher. So that's a basic concept about why we need blood pressure, and why does the blood pressure change because of so many reasons.
Sure. Again, just staying here, so there is a systolic and diastolic, the two pressures that are there. What are these? And if these change, that is, if they go beyond the normal range, they go higher or lower, what's happening to our bodies then?
Sure. And just think of it as a controlled environment and think of it as a chemical process. And for a chemical process, you need a catalyst, you need a temperature. If the temperature is too high, the reaction slows down. If the temperature is too low, the reaction doesn't happen. So given those conditions, the body needs to function with a certain amount of blood pressure. The body organs are settled into function with a pressure of 140, at least 140 systolic, and a diastolic of at least 80. So the range of systolic in a healthy individual can range between 110 to 140 systolic, and diastolic between, 68 to 80. Now, what is systolic and what is diastolic? To understand the meaning of systole and diastole, the heart pumps blood, right? To pump blood, it needs to contract and then relax. Contract and then relax. So when the heart contracts, the blood escapes from the heart and goes to the rest of the body. When the heart relaxes, blood comes back from the body and fills inside the chambers of the heart. So you cannot have just pumping without filling it. You know, if you take a small pipette or a syringe, you can't just have it incessantly putting out water. It needs to get filled. So therefore, the heart has two components, systole when it contracts, diastole when it reacts. Now, when you look at the time period of it, the contraction is shorter than the relaxation, which means the relaxation period is longer. So people often try and think that the systolic, the upper blood pressure, is the only important thing, and that's absolutely wrong. The lower blood pressure is equally important, and it sometimes, if your heart rate is low, it's more important because your heart and your body is exposed to a higher period when it's in the relaxation mode. That's called the diastole. Okay, so if you just a rule of thumb for a lot of listeners, what constitutes a high blood pressure? When do you get concerned when your blood pressure is above a certain value? So traditionally across the world, as of today's guidelines, any blood pressure systolic above the number of 140 and a diastolic persistently above 80 is not good. It means something is brewing, okay? And it's also important when you check your blood pressure. And this is what I tell a lot of people. You know, if you check your blood pressure immediately after an exercise, guess what? It's going to be high because that's how it's supposed to be. So if you check your blood pressure immediately after waking up from sleep, it's going to be high. That's how it is. And physiology states that every time you have a meal, your blood pressure goes up. So ideally, you need to be testing your blood pressure after you've been seated for 10 or 15 minutes and then check it then. The blood pressure also varies with position. Like if you're lying down, it's a little different. If you're standing up, it's a little different. When you're seated, it's a little different. I won't go into the details of that. But I think for a lot of us, it should be the same. I would say that always check your blood pressure when you're seated for 10 or 15 minutes, and then make sure the BP apparatus is at the level of the heart, and you can do it that way.
Got it. That's very important. Thank you so much for already detailing that, how to test the blood pressure, because people may be panicking without maybe correctly checking it. What I do, so in the whole family, we keep a log. And thanks to you, after that, we try to keep a log of every month for about 7 days in the morning, maybe after waking up 30 to 45 minutes after we are seated, and then try to get the three different measurements. And I try to take the average of it for a week. And every month we try to do, mom does it, dad does it, I do it. And I see that it gives an indication of where it needs attention. I don't know whether it's correct, but this is some of the guidelines that I had seen and basis that we've been following.
Absolutely. I think it's a very, very smart thing to do. Because one, you get basic data, and not just in medicine, across the world, across IT, across so many other things, we found that the greater the data, the better the analysis. And when we have a change in the data, we can pick up the change much earlier. So I think it's very important for all of us to keep a record. I do it as well. And, sometimes people come up to you and they tell you that my blood pressure is low. It's like 100 by 60. You know, it's nothing to worry. Some people are innately born with low blood pressure. And unless people are finding any kind of symptoms of lightheadedness or dizziness with a pressure below 100 by 60, I would not panic or worry about it. Any blood pressure value that is, you know, below 90 by 60 needs an evaluation just to make sure the heart is fine, just to make sure you do not have any disease in the heart. And if that evaluation is good, I don't think we should be panicking about the blood pressure too much.
Got it. And on the higher side, is it also that inherently it could be slightly higher for certain people or not?
Yeah, well, I think it inherently it could be, or let's put it genetically, it could be. Like, for example, if you have a blood pressure that's persistently, say the systolic is 130, which is in the range, and the lower one, the diastolic, is persistently above 90, 95, that's not good. Because that still constitutes high blood pressure. Your heart is exposed to that high blood pressure every single second of the day, every year, for years together. So that has a lot of side effects on different parts of the body. It can affect practically every segment, but it has a large effect which manifests and shows on the heart, on the kidneys, and the brain. So that's something that's not good. Now, if your blood pressure systolic, the upper one, is clearly above 150, that again is a recipe for problems going on. So, you know, a stitch in time saves nine. Well, that adage holds good for blood pressure too.
Right. This is pretty detailed and very helpful. Now, the last question on blood pressure is, if it is high, for example, for people, how it is contributing to the coronary arteries disease?
Okay. I mean, the analogy is, again, you have a beautiful house, you have lots of high-five gadgets, and you have electric wiring everywhere. Okay. If, and we know that the electricity would go at 220 volts, at least in India, but in place of 220 volts, if you let the voltage go at 300, 260, 280, we know that it's going to damage the functioning of every single appliance at home. The same thing is with the body. The body is used or subjected to be working at a certain amount of blood pressure. A high blood pressure puts excessive strain on the heart. The heart has to pump against a greater pressure. The heart muscle kind of becomes bigger and bigger, something that we call hypertrophy. You know, it's just like a muscle man, a guy who's gymming in. You know, if you just lift your hand and flex your hands with a 1 kg dumbbell, you're not going to develop your biceps. But in place of 1 kilo, you're going to put 20 kilos, you're going to have higher biceps, which means greater the resistance, greater the hypertrophy or the increase in size of the muscle. Now, whereas in bodybuilding that may be beneficial to some, in the heart it is not. The greater the blood pressure, the greater the pressure on the muscle to become bigger and bigger, and that causes different kinds of problems later going on. So this is one effect on the heart. The second effect, high blood pressure can cause kidney damage. The kidney is functioning at a certain limit, and if that pressure goes on, a lot of the kidney cells get damaged. And over time, it can cause kidney failure and may require dialysis. And the third and the most apparent thing of high blood pressure is when you have a very high blood pressure, say 160, 180, the blood vessels in the brain can have a small rupture causing a bleed. So this can be catastrophic, can be lethal at times, causing a massive stroke. A stroke is when you're not able to kind of move your hands or your legs, and can cause paralysis. So it can affect every system, but these three systems are manifest very badly and, you know, with sometimes fatal consequences.
Right. Thank you so much. And this is very helpful also, because anecdotally, what I've seen in my experience is people are in denial, or they think, hey, if they start a medicine for blood pressure with the help of a doctor, they are going to be on it for a long period of time, and that will create further complications and many other things that are there. So thank you for explaining that very well.
Absolutely. You know, so many a times I've seen that people are resistant to start medication. Nobody likes to take medication. And I think if people are married, men especially, they accept medications easier than if they're single. I don't know why that happens. That's beyond my purview. But I think that, you know, everybody wants to know if they can get rid of medication. This is a question I get asked many times. If your hypertension is caused due to poor lifestyle, lack of sleep, bad food habits, lack of exercise, I recommend people to start medication initially and at the same time start modifying their lifestyle. You know, sleep at the right time, wake up at the right time, have the right kind of food, cut down your salt considerably. And there's a lot of hidden salt in the food that we eat. Forget about the salt that we add on. A lot of food contains hidden salt. So you cut down that, you get a good exercise regime. A lot of the people with secondary hypertension that's coming due to lifestyle can be managed without medication. So just because you start medication at one time doesn't mean you need to take it for life. I have a significant amount of patients who deal with me who have been off medication after strictly following lifestyle changes. So literally, that is in their hands.
Yeah. Thank you. It's a bit boring, mundane, but it is in our hands for sure. Also, one other point you talked about as soon as you started to talk about blood pressure was that it could be also due to the cholesterol. And it seems like a number of things are all interrelated. And that's why I wanted to request understanding of the cholesterol, the lipid profile. Someone says, hey, the HDL is fine, should be higher. The LDL you can ignore, or the LDL is the bad one. And so long as HDL even is at the normal end of it, it's not as bad. Can I request your help in understanding what exactly is cholesterol, what exactly is it doing to us in the blood? And then towards the end, I want to understand, is it the dietary cholesterol? Is it the blood cholesterol? How both are these connected? Because I have seen a lot of discussion around that as well. So I will hand it over to you for your explanation.
Oh, sure. I mean, and this is an amazing thing, you know. So I once was given a talk in a national conference of dietitians in India. And I proposed, you know, I asked them one question and I told them about a particular study which cut down, you know, all the dietary cholesterol that is there in your food. You cut down all the cholesterol that is there in the food and study the people for 10 years. At the end of that, I asked them the question, what did you think they found? Did you find that there was a decrease in heart disease or an increase in heart disease? And all of them, 500 of them, nearly all of them answered like, no, there has to be a decrease in heart disease. But the answer was not that. There was actually an increase in heart disease. So it's very important to understand how complex cholesterol is. Cholesterol is not bad. Your body needs cholesterol. Why? Because a lot of basic functions are based on cholesterol. If you're thinking and using your brain, that's because cholesterol is lining the nerve fibers in your brain. Okay? If you're having testosterone in your body and doing a lot of things because of the testosterone, testosterone is based on cholesterol. If there was no cholesterol, there'd be no testosterone, no vitamin D, no estrogen, no progesterone. So whether we like it or not, even if we have zero cholesterol in our food, our body synthesizes more cholesterol than we can actually eat in a day. Okay, so that is what it is. So the body uses a structure. It's created by light falling under our skin, and just like vitamin D. So that's how it's basically created out there. So, but there are certain kind of people, and this is again based on a study, who are called responders. Now, what are these responders? If you give a cholesterol-rich diet to certain people who have no heart disease and you follow them up, then we found that small percentage of people, 5 to 10% of the people, respond to the cholesterol in diet, which means the more cholesterol they eat, the more cholesterol they develop in the body. So that's not good for them. So those are the kind of people who need to cut down strictly on dietary cholesterol. So it's an important thing. Now, secondly, there are certain people who have heart disease or who have other kind of neurovascular disease. They can have a history of stroke. For all these people as well, it's important to cut down on the cholesterol levels because we know that cholesterol is a causative factor. Cholesterol and its different components are a causative factor for heart disease as well as brain disease, neurovascular disease. So this is what it stands. Now, cholesterol has different components, and I'll quickly go into what it means. Everything is not good, and only one of them is good. Okay, and one of them is the one which is good is called the HDL. Okay, so the HDL is the only thing you need to remember is the good cholesterol. If your values are more than 40, it's really good. There are no real medications to increase the HDL. There are no shortcuts. It increases with regular exercise and some amount of balance in food, which is high omega-3, omega-6 fatty acids, and so on and so forth. All the other cholesterols are bad. Total cholesterol is the sum of other cholesterols like LDL, VLDL, and many other micro components. So this is the nutshell. You know, there are certain guidelines given across. It's good to have a low cholesterol level because that prevents, early formation of heart disease. The corollary of that is also true sometimes, because I've seen people with heart disease having absolutely normal cholesterol levels, which means having normal cholesterol levels does not prevent you from heart disease, because heart disease is multifactorial. There are many things. Cholesterol is one of the things that contributes to it. In the cholesterol lipid profile, you will also find another segment called triglyceride. Now, this is very important, especially in India, because there are a lot of genetic diseases in which the triglyceride level is crazily high. You know, normally you want a level of triglyceride below 150, 160, 170 is okay. You know, I have seen last week in clinic somebody with a level of 1,200.
Wow.
Exactly, 1,200. And it's not odd. You know, we do see them on and off. A 400 and 500 is there. Lean guy runs 5 kilometers every day, looks as fit as a fiddle. But guess what? You can't judge a book by its cover. And that's the importance of actually testing and then, you know, knowing what's going on. You know, many people ask me, Dr. Adil, if you tell me, you've told me 7 risk factors that lead to heart disease. You know, out of all 7 of them, tell me one risk factor, which is the most important risk factor. What would it be? And I look to them and I grin, and, you know, with a sly smile, and I tell them, you know, the risk factor which I have not mentioned, it's the 8th risk factor. And they all look up to me and say, what is the 8th risk factor then? I said, it's ignorance. Ignoring the fact that you can have the disease, ignoring that you need to get yourself checked up, ignoring the data the world has on heart disease, that is the biggest risk factor. And in today's generation, especially to many members who are listening to this podcast, ignorance, ignoring all these facts, is the biggest risk factor. So it's important to get yourself checked, evaluated. Fitness is not just a state of the body, it's a state of the mind. And I'm sure you can speak much more on that than I do, but I can tell you that, you know, it goes in tandem. You know, the heart and mind go in tandem. And the cholesterol is one of the important things that you need to evaluate, to check, and to control as well. You know, a lot of people ask me about ghee. You know, I said, sure, you can have, you know, there are a lot of studies which show that a lot of ghee is good for you. I said, it's great for you if you work out 4 hours a day. You know, our forefathers and our forefathers before them used to have a lot of food with ghee on it, because it reduced the glycemic index, which means the food gets absorbed very slowly. The sugar levels don't go high, which is amazing. But the total amount of calories generated needs to be expended, which means if you're doing a good amount of hard work, please have the ghee by all means. But if you're going to be sitting behind the computer or sitting in an AC room and letting your mind do the work, well, that's going to work against you.
Yeah, no, I agree. And thank you for explaining this so well. People living in denial, ignoring it and saying that, hey, because I'm working out or because I get up and go to the gym or I'm running, I'm almost immune to everything else. And when something happens, we see often, we starting to discuss that, hey, this happened to us even though this person was working out regularly. We have had certain cases, cardiac cases in the last 1 year, at least in the running community across the country, where we have had so much of discussion, so much of charcha happening that why it happened to this guy was an Ultraman, he was an Ironman, an XYZ. But I think in my understanding, people start to have this myth that they forget to differentiate between being fit and being healthy. Both are not the same thing. And just staying at cholesterol, the genetic predisposition of it, because what I have seen earlier and like what you said, a lot of dietitians start to talk about that, hey, it has to be dietary. And while there could be implications because of the fat deposition, etc., but what in your opinion is the genetic predisposition when it comes to cholesterol in India as a country?
Sure. So in India, there's a lot of data on 2 particular genetic diseases that exist in families that lead to early problems with the heart, with the brain, and so on. One is called familial hypercholesterolemia. It's a big name, of course. It just means your cholesterol levels are high despite all diet, exercise, everything, simply because there's a gene that's sitting on your liver that's not working as fine, and it's come from either your mama, your nani, or some kind of connect like that, and that's giving you high cholesterol. And the second one, and the more dangerous one, and it's also more rampant, is familial hypertriglyceridemia. All it means, again, a big long name, it means is your triglyceride levels are out of whack, not because of what you've eaten, not because you're not exercising, it's because of the genetic condition. Again, an enzyme of the liver is causing it. So especially for people who are diagnosed with familial conditions like this, it's imperative for them to actually be on medication because data has shown that they can lead to early heart or neurovascular disease. So I think judging just everybody as one is not the right answer. But I think it's important that if you have any of these conditions, it's important to meet a good cardiologist and take into all the other data points and decide whether you need to be on medication besides just your lifestyle and diet changes.
Right. Thank you. So we started by starting to talk about CAD, so coronary arteries disease, and these being contributors in some way or another. Now, from cholesterol, when we start to think of it, how it's contributing to a coronary arteries disease. I understood from a blood pressure point of view,
sure.
But as a layperson, I have still not understood how is cholesterol actually helping.
The cholesterol is the hard water going through a pipe. So the cholesterol is going to lead to depositions inside the arteries, not on the outside. And it's like a volcano that's growing up, but not growing on the outside, but growing towards the inside of your heart pipe, you know, the petrol pipe of your heart. It's growing inside, and over time, it keeps increasing. It's like, you know, one of those TV serials. You've seen the first episode, you know what's going to happen in the next and the one after that. So it starts with some inflammation, some muscle cell comes in, cholesterol gets deposited, some more inflammation, some more muscle cells, some more cholesterol, and then finally a nice cap of calcium. And one fine day, that either, you know, it may just reach up to be 100%, or the calcium cap can rupture or break just like a volcano erupts. And overnight, within a few minutes as well, sometimes you can have a blood clot on that plaque, making it 100% block. So calcium, cholesterol, smooth muscle cells, inflammation, all of them are part of the same disease that decreases the diameter of your blood vessels on the inside, which means it narrows them and makes less blood go to your heart. And if you're at rest, you know, this doesn't really make an impact. But the minute you start walking or you start gymming or running, as most of your listeners would do, a narrowed artery can decrease the blood supply to the heart when the demand is going up. So the difference between the supply and demand precipitates a heart attack. Mm. Or precipitate some kind of chest pain. That's
got it. So now, is it happening? It's going to happen overnight that I got high cholesterol, and now overnight I may have just this plaque getting built up, and that's going to cause a disease, or it takes decades.
I mean, you go out of the house and you see this beautiful tree right in front of your house. Well, it did not come yesterday. You know, it started with a seed. It became a shrub, a shrubling, and then it went on, you know. So the same thing with cholesterol. It usually follows a series. You know, we see a trend. If you know the trend, you can prevent the event. If you ignore the trend, you only see an event, which could be dangerous. So cholesterol doesn't happen overnight. It's a trend, and a trend can be picked up biochemically by doing a lot of tests, can be picked up physically as well by doing certain scans. Or it can be picked up clinically when you actually have a problem. So you don't wait for the clinical change. You can pick it up at the biochemical stage.
Got it. So what I'm thinking is with the way we have started, I guess it might just take a few hours for us to cover everything. Maybe we'll stay with the coronary arteries disease, and I'll request maybe a couple of other times your time whenever you are free to just go through a couple of other conditions and just stay here for a few more minutes, if that is okay with you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Not a worry at all.
Thank you. So it seems like it doesn't happen overnight. And so since it doesn't happen overnight, what happens also is if something is going to happen later, something that's far out, people tend to ignore the danger of it as well, and it has the compounding effect. But people one ignore, and second thing also is a lot of times we as humans, if we do not have symptoms, we think something is not there. And so what I wanted to understand is how early we should start to get these tests done, and what could some of these tests be? Not at the cost of being very generic, but I'm thinking if one has to figure out their cardiac profile, start to figure out where they stand, how should they start to look at their blood tests or any other tests that they need to take?
So I think that's a very important question, and I have a message, an anecdotal message from my own example. I was in my second year of med school. My dad's always been a health freak, and he told me, "Adil, go ahead and check your cholesterol." And I told him, "Dad, I'm like 19. Do I really need to check my cholesterol?" After his insistence, I did check it, and guess what? It was high at the age of 19. And over the past 30 plus years or so, I've made sure that I've kept my exercise routine, my food, and so many other things, and I've kept it well under control without any medication. So I think there is no starting age, but I feel that if you have a family history of disease or somebody in your family has an issue, I think you've got to start early. Maybe just get a test done once you're in your 20s, just to get a basic test of what's going on in your body. And by a basic test, you know, you don't need to get 1,000 tests done by some of these companies that have given a whole battery of tests. You don't need to get your beryllium, silver, all these things. I think a basic thing that we need to do is just check your fasting lipid profile. A good lab is very important. You need to have at least an 8 to 10 hours fasting. And apart from that, I would like to test for something called an HbA1c. Now, the HbA1c is your average blood sugar over the past 6 to 8 weeks. You know, and that gives you a good idea how your carbohydrate content in the body is and whether you're leaning and going towards a pre-diabetic state or not. So I think these two things are very few basic things that you need to do. I think in today's world, when the first age of the first heart attack is decreasing every now and every then, you know, like currently in a city like Bangalore, the average age of the first heart attack has come down to 36. Whereas, 36, exactly. And 20 years ago, that was like 50-something. So we've seen a drastic sea of change. So if you're in your 30s and you've never checked yourself up, please do get a basic ECG and echo, and maybe even get a treadmill test. You know, all these tests are non-invasive. Like a treadmill test doesn't require you to take an injection, and it gives you a safe degree of comfort. Like, you know, I think your heart is in reasonably good condition. No test is absolute, 100% guarantee, no way. But these tests can give you at least a 90 to 95% of comfort that whatever is going on in your heart is reasonably good. The blood test can be done earlier, especially if you have a heart disease running in your family. It does not need to be your immediate family. It could be your uncles or grandparents who've had some kind of high cholesterol and things like that, and get yourself checked up. Once you do find that there is some abnormality, that is the omen or a sign that you need to go on for periodic checkups. You don't need to do it every month, but at least once in a year. You know, once again, the car analogy, service your car once a year, even if it's a Ferrari.
Right. And for coronary arteries disease specifically, how do you figure this out that you may have a plaque getting built up, for example? What I'm understanding is ECG or 2-day echo may not be giving the plaque built up, right? So could that be?
I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to cut you, but I think you're absolutely right. And you know, you want to buy a car, you go into the showroom, you see the car, it looks amazing. You open the door, you sit it on, you turn the engine on, and then you walk out. You're not going to buy it then. What are you going to do? You're going to take it for a test drive. The same thing with your heart. You know, doing an echo and an ECG is doing when your heart is resting. It's not testing your heart. You need to test your heart when it's running. And by that, I mean you need to do a treadmill test. And that's why I think if you really want to have your heart checked up, do get a treadmill test. And that gives you a 95% accuracy of what's going on. I would not recommend an angiogram for everybody. An angiogram should be reserved for people who have a positive test, who have, you know, very, very significant symptoms, because every angiogram does have a 1% risk either of a stroke or something related to the kidneys, or small percentage risk. It's largely very safe, but I would say strongly it's an intervention, and therefore it needs to be reserved for people who totally need it. And the same thing goes with the CT coronary angiogram. I think it's an overkill of diagnosing it. There are many other newer tests that are non-invasive, that don't give you an injection, a pass of wire, and can get a rough idea of what's going on in your arteries. They are more expensive, they're more complex, and I'd reserve them after you see your physician. But for a starter, a treadmill test
got
is the basic.
Got it. Makes sense. There was one more point that was left. I think the last point was on coronary artery disease was nutrition. What you're eating and how that can be a contributor to this condition. How could that be? Is it that I've seen from what I read, I see that over a period of time, we eat now less and less nutrient-dense food. And as a result, what happens is for us to get the same amount of protein, same amount of macronutrient, we need to ingest a lot more calories. And that seems like also is loading our body with weight and everything else. I wanted to understand from your point of view, how is our current nutrition habits helping us get to this disease condition as well?
So I think this is a very, very elaborate topic and I can go on for a long time on it, but I'll keep it very simple with a few salient points. I always say recapitulate what was going on years and years ago, and that is eat local. Whether it's fruit, whether it's grain, you belong to a certain area, your genes, and if you're in that particular area, your genes, your genetics are kind of adjusted to that, eat local. If there's any food that you can eat raw, please eat it raw. If you can't eat it raw and you need to steam it, steam it. If not, kind of air fry it or dehydrate it or grill it or tandoor it, saute it, and the last thing you need to do is to fry it. Okay, so if you can eat something raw, eat it raw. People often ask me, fruits are great. I said, yeah, sure, but fruits also have a lot of sugar in them, so you need to limit the kind of fruit that you eat. And also, if you compare an orange, I'd rather everybody, including children, have the entire orange with the fiber around it than have a glass of orange juice. So a glass of orange juice is not very good for you. It just shoots up your sugar very high, and it's not just cholesterol. Sugar, salt, and cholesterol are all members of the same team, and they're all working against you. So all of them are bad. So salt, sugar, and cholesterol needs to be cut in your diet. The more simple your food is, the safer it is for you. Gone are the days that we would think 3 square meals a day. I think current data has shown that you can have the same amount that you eat in 3 square meals a day, but divided into 6 meals a day, or maybe even 7. That puts less amount of strain on your pancreas, which secrete a lot of enzymes for digestion. Especially if you're diabetic, this helps even more. So, simple food, avoid all the fried food, avoid complex food, avoid processed foods. If you can eat, say, a simple thing, wheat, whether it's a roti or it's like poha, simple things, rather than process, because processing adds on many other chemicals, many other additives, many other maybe saturated fats, that's not good for you. All of us have a weakness for bakery stuff, but even baked products are not great. The simpler and more natural the food it is, the better it is. The third point I'd like to say is when you look at your plate, the more colorful your plate with natural ingredients, the better it is. When I'm talking about color, it could be green leafy veggies. When we talk about salad, the concept that most people have is cucumber, tomatoes, yeah. Carrots. No, that is not salad. You need to have a lot of green leaves, red leaves, maybe even capsicum, bell peppers, red, yellow. Have a couple of flax seeds, chia seeds, a couple of walnuts, everything in moderation. The key to a good nutrition is balance. Zero oil is bad for you. So you need to have some amount of oil in food, but stay away from the processed foods, stay away from salt, sugar, and all the fried stuff.
Fantastic. Quite information-packed conversation this has been. I'm going to request you maybe in the coming weeks and months, whenever your time permits, maybe we pick up the other parts of the conversation. And today we limited it to coronary arteries disease, because I think this itself will be significant amount of information for our listeners. If that is okay, I think then we are nearing the end of our conversation today.
Absolutely, Vikas. Thank you so much, first and foremost, for the opportunity to be here. I think it's great. It's a win-win for both of us because this is what I do professionally. I like to reach out this message to a lot of people. I do a lot of robotic heart surgeries and all these complex stuff. But what gives me greatest pleasure is preventing heart disease. And that can only be done through forums like this and the kind of work that you're doing. Amazing. Please do continue on that. And I'm sure if your listeners give you the feedback, they want to hear more of us together, I would be happy to be on the show again.
No, thank you so much. And we will get enough feedback very quickly, and I'm sure very positive. So I'm going to reach out to you again and request for time again. Thank you so much for being here today. If people want to reach out to you, what's the right way for them to be able to reach out to you?
So they can reach out to me by an email, and I can share it out to you, and they can do that. It's like a work email as well. And if they have any questions or queries, I can try and help them out. Obviously, it wouldn't be an instant answer, not like Instamart of Swiggy, but I will take time to go through them, and I will be happy to reach out to them. No worries. I'll share it with you.
Got it. So maybe we'll put that in the show notes also. Maybe if they want to connect, meet up in Bangalore, and whenever you have time for an appointment or something like that, they can go through the hospital channel, whichever way you think is right.
Absolutely. No worries.
Thank you so much for your time. Have a good evening. That was all. Wasn't it informative? This was fantastic, isn't it? I loved a lot. I understood a lot about heart functions, and CAD, that is coronary arteries disease. Let me know how it went for you guys, and we'll be very happy to have Dr. Adil again on the show. Good luck, and speak to you next week again.